calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. A lot in the news today. Tim Russert, that Mr. Libby must be lying. Looks like it. In Fort Lewis, a mistrial in Lieutenant Aaron Wintada's trial. We'll get into some details on that. George Bush's advisors apparently are telling him to attack Iran to show how smart he is. Meanwhile, Misters Pace and Gates, or General Pace and Mr. Gates, say congressional debate on the war doesn't hurt our troops. $12 billion in Iraq disappears on our watch. 60 countries sign a treaty saying they won't hold people in secret. Bush won't sign it. And coming up in the next hour, John Patrick Diggins claims history has judged Ronald Reagan as one of America's best presidents. Oh, yeah? We'll be discussing that. Congresswoman Barbara Lee is with us right now. She represents the 9th District of California. Her website, lee.house.gov. And Congresswoman Lee, welcome to the program.
Yes, glad to be with you, Tom.
I am so pleased and honored to have you with us. You hosted a forum on Capitol Hill Wednesday where experts came in and discussed the possible consequences of the United States, the Bush administration, staging a preemptive attack on Iran. Did I get that right?
Yes, actually we held a forum quite similar last year. And, of course, that was when we were in the basement. We hadn't won the majority. And
right.
This time we had it in the Cannon caucus building. And it was quite a remarkable forum. We had Dr. Piller, who's the professor at Georgetown, Dr. Gardner. We had Dr. Parsi and several other panelists who talked about what they see in terms of the future as it relates to U.S. policy and possible military action against Iran. What was interesting is that most indicated that there may not be a plan on the drawing board for an attack, but that the rhetoric and the military maneuvers, you know, sending the aircraft into the region,
mm-hmm.
and the accusations with regard to Iran being responsible, you know, for kidnappings and, you know, all of the signs are that there could be, acts of provocation that could take place.
Yeah, we've seen this movie before.
We've seen it before that caused the Iranians, you know, to be backed into a corner and then look out. And so I'm very worried about what I see taking place. The panelists were worried, and that's why I decided to go on and introduce a resolution that says, it made actually a statement of policy that the United States will not enter into a preemptive war against Iran.
Yeah.
Of course, in the absence of an imminent threat, and then in accordance with international law and constitution, the president always has the authority to use force in case of imminent threat. But also, my resolution blocks the use of funds for covert action for the purpose of causing regime change. Again, we've seen this before also.
Well, we're doing that right now, are we not? My understanding is that we have special forces troops inside Iran right now and that we've been supporting MEC, the terrorist organization inside the state of Iran.
Yeah, but we shouldn't be. We're trying to get a policy to block the funds for this. I mean, that's what my resolution would do, stop the funding of this effort.
Wow.
Also, we are saying in my resolution that no prior authorization of Congress constitutes an authorization to use force against Iran and that there should be no preconditions to engage in dialogue with Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have to be very strategic and we have to move forward. And the administration said they had no plans to use force, but then they put the military option back on the table.
Back in January of 2003, before George Bush had invaded Iraq, were very clear that it was inevitable. George Bush said,
"You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you."
And then he used imminent danger. You know, you have mushroom cloud and all this kind of thing. What would happen, even if your resolution was passed, what would happen if we were successful, the administration was successful in provoking Iran into some sort of attack on us? I mean, so far, on two occasions now in the last week, we have apparently kidnapped their ambassadors inside Iraq or members of their ambassadorial staff. What happens if somehow they do something which we can interpret in a Gulf of Tonkin type of fashion?
Well, first, I think what we have to focus on is keeping them from doing that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the issue. How do we keep this administration from using force and for from aged and provocative actions that would cause that kind of a spiraling out of control of what could take place. And what I'm saying is that we have to and we must engage Iran right away, I think, in diplomatic dialogue to help reduce the tensions, because otherwise the description you described, what you just described, could take place. And that is a place where we do not need to go, because that opens Pandora's box for another war, and that we could not tolerate. When the president gave his State of the Union speech several years ago, he talked about the axis of evil, Iran, Iraq, North Korea. He then talked about his doctrine of preemptive war, and they reaffirmed that again last year. This is the policy of the United States, to use preemption as a military and foreign policy option when, in fact, they want to use force. And so that's why I am very worried, I am very concerned, and I hope the American people go to their members of Congress and say, do not let this happen, support H.R. 770, and support efforts to get Iran to the table to engage in dialogue. Yes, Secretary Rice claims that she doesn't remember any of these overtures and the opening that we had several years ago. I quite frankly don't believe that. And I think that they don't want to talk to Iran, and they want the situation to occur. And for what reason, I have no idea. But I think that we're on a very dangerous track, and I hope people understand that in our country.
This is House Resolution 770. I'm sorry, the number was 770. Okay, and people can call. The toll-free number for Congress is 866-220-0044, or the direct line to Capitol Hill, 202-225-3121. If you're not sure who your member of the House of Representatives is, simply give them your zip code. They'll be able to connect you directly to the office of your member of Congress of the House of Representatives, and also call your two senators and tell them that, you know, any efforts in the on the side of the Senate, on the part of the Senate that would correspond with what Barbara Lee is doing with House Resolution 770 in the House are things that you support. Congresswoman Barbara Lee, we have about 2 minutes left. I know you have to go, and we have to, you know, the exigencies of commercial radio. Was there a consensus among all these experts about what would happen if we do get into a hot conflict with Iran?
The consensus was that we do not want to do that, because this, in essence, would, of course, increase the threat to our country. It would be huge. National security issues, national security problems for us, huge homeland security problems, huge issues that with regard to terrorism that we're trying to address. And so it would not help in this, whatever their global war on terror is, to start a war with Iran. The consequences would be grave. Everyone agrees with that. The panelists agreed. We all agreed. And that's why we're doing everything we can do to try to stop this before it happens.
But you've got a bunch of neocons out there who don't agree.
Well, we have. You're right.
You know, Fox News is whipping this stuff up every day.
Every day. In fact,
even the major, even the major networks now are starting to, and particularly the cable networks, they've come up with logos, you know, threat Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And the headlines in the newspaper talking about the threat. And whenever they refer to Iran's nuclear program, their nuclear power plant program, it's referred to in a way that sort of suggests that it's not just that. I mean, it may not just be that, but it implies that it's not that at all.
Well, they did this in the march up to war with Iraq. I mean, the press did this. This was part of their strategy. And I hope people understand the elections in November sent a very strong message in terms of where the American people are with regard to this war against Iraq, which is a civil war and an occupation. People need to understand that the media and the White House, they're consolidating their efforts now with this one message, and that they did not tell the truth, and they misled the American people on Iraq, and they're doing this on Iran, and do not believe that kind I call it brainwashing,
mm-hmm.
and don't believe that kind of collusion with the administration in terms of the media. It's outrageous.
It is. We have only about a half a minute left. Any idea why the administration would do this?
It's hard to imagine why this administration does anything, quite frankly. It's hard to imagine why they would go against the Constitution, why they would go against the American people, why Cheney, Rice, Bush, Gates, and, of course, Rumsfeld, why they are set on being this small group of individuals who are totally thwarting totally thwarting democracy, totally eroding our Constitution, and totally creating a more dangerous world. I don't know why they're doing it.
Yeah. Congresswoman Barbara Lee, please, and to our listener, our listeners, please contact your member of Congress and tell them to support H.R. 770, House Resolution 770. Congresswoman Barbara Lee, thanks so much for having the courage to hold these hearings and submit this legislation. Thank you very much.
Thanks for giving us the opportunity to talk with you today.
Thank you. 16 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you, the place where our talking points come from, Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. 20 minutes past the hour. Let's take a look at what's going on with the ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones.
Following our security developments in Iraq as of 0900 hours Greenwich Mean Time today, Thursday, compiled by Reuters, Dateline Azazia. A car bomb in a vegetable market killed 17 people, wounded 27. In Mosul, police found 7 bullet-riddled bodies dumped in that city. In Garma, police found the bodies of 3 people with gunshot wounds to the head. Near Fallujah, a car bomb exploded near a mosque and killed a worshiper and killed 4 others on Wednesday. In Baghdad, gunmen attacked the convoy of Amr Tu'uma, a member of the Fahila Shiite political party, and wounded one of his guards near the Mansour district in western Baghdad. In Baghdad, U.S. and Iraqi forces raided the health ministry building in central Baghdad and arrested Hakim Zamili, the deputy health minister. In Baghdad, a car bomb killed 6 and wounded 10 others in the new Baghdad district in eastern Baghdad. In Surayra, three roadside bombs exploded in quick succession, killing 7 people and wounding 23 others on Wednesday. And in Baqaba, gunmen attacked a rapid reaction police unit and killed 4 policemen and a civilian in that religiously mixed city. Grim stuff. And in the meantime, Grover Norquist in Vanity Fair, Craig Unger, writes this. Actually, it's a very thoughtful, very detailed, in-depth article about the neocon advisors who are talking to George W. Bush. Who are giving Bush his advice, telling him what he should be doing, telling, you know, all that kind of stuff. And quotes to Grover Norquist, who says, here's his exact quote. Everything the advocates of war said that would happen hasn't happened, said the president of Americans for Tax Reform, Grover Norquist, an influential conservative who backed the Iraq invasion. All the things the critics said would happen have happened. The president's neocon advisors are effectively saying, invade Iran, then everyone will see how smart you are. But after we've lost X number of times at the roulette wheel, do you double down? Apparently. Richard Perle, former Bush administration official, quote, I have very little doubt that Bush would order necessary military action against Iran. He says, make no mistake, President Bush will need to bomb Iran's nuclear facilities before leaving office. Excuse me, that second quote wasn't from Richard Perle. It was from American Enterprise Institute analyst Joshua Muravachik. A couple of other points from the Unger article. This is from thinkprogress.org, by the way. Retired Defense Intelligence official Patrick Lang told Unger that Bush had ordered STRATCOM, the military command responsible for nuclear weapons, missile defense, and protection against weapons of mass destruction. You get this? This is the big dog, right? STRATCOM. Bush has ordered them to draw up plans for, quote, a massive strike against Iran, end quote. Lang noted that the shift away from Central Command to STRATCOM indicates that they're talking about a really punishing Air Force and naval air attack on Iran, which would make sense given that most of our allies in the Gulf have said, no, you can't You can't attack Iran from our base. Jim Webb, the new senator, Jim Webb on Hardball and Chris Matthews' program, talking about how carriers in the Gulf could set off something catastrophic.
You know, one thing, if you look at where we are in the Persian Gulf right now, when I was Secretary of the Navy, and until very recently, we never operated aircraft carriers inside the Persian Gulf, because number one, the turning radius is pretty close, and number two, the chance of accidentally bumping into something that would start a diplomatic situation was pretty high. We now have been doing that, and with the tensions as high as they are, I'm very worried that we might accidentally set something off in there, and we need to, as a Congress, to get ahead of the ballgame here.
That's Jim Webb. Now, keep in mind, he was the Secretary of the Navy under Ronald Reagan. Under Ronald Reagan. I mean, the Persian Gulf is like this little bathtub, and there's all these 40% of the world's oil goes through the Persian Gulf. It goes in and out of the Straits of Hormuz. The Persian Gulf is like the giant bathtub, and the little tiny drain at the end that, you know, that leads out is the Straits of Hormuz. And Iran controls half of those straits. That's one side of it. And they're putting missiles there. In fact, they're putting missiles all along the border. Another point that was in the Unger article in Vanity Fair, Craig Unger's article, former CIA officer Philip Giraldi says, I've heard from sources at the Pentagon that their impression is that the White House has made a decision that war is going to happen. Barbara Lee is so right. We need to stop this thing before it starts. House Resolution 770. A good starting point. 26 minutes past the hour. Our phone number, 1-866-440-TOM, T-H-O-M, 440-T-H-O-M. We'll be right back.
Life's like a road that you travel on. There's one day here and the next day gone. Sometimes you bend, sometimes you stand. Sometimes you turn your back to the wind. There's a world outside every darkened door where blues won't haunt you anymore. Where the brave are free and lovers soar. Come ride with me to the distant shore. We won't hesitate to break down a garden gate. There's not much time left today. Yeah. Life is a
And welcome back, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone here in the People's Republic of Little Beirut, also known as Portland, Oregon. Tom Hartman here with you, 33 minutes past the hour, 34 minutes past the hour now. George Bush.
So I hear the voices, and I read the front page, and I know the speculation, but I'm the decider, and I decide what is best.
Yeah, and last time around he said that it was the inspectors, you'll recall.
The larger point is, and the fundamental question is, does Saddam Hussein have a weapons program?
Nope.
And the answer is absolutely.
Nope.
And we gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in.
And he did.
And he wouldn't let them in.
Yes, he did.
And therefore, after a reasonable request, we decided to remove him from power along with other nations.
Other nations too, huh?
Make sure he was not a threat. To the United States.
Yeah, we decided to remove him from power along with other nations, and the other nation is what? Iran? Is that what's coming next? 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Scott in Ohio, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Tom.
Hey.
Listen, this is real quick, I hope. I think they figured out that they will not have enough troops to get them through the last 2 years of Bush's administration. I'm referring to Iraq and Afghanistan. And as the one final trick to maintain troop strength, I think they're going to invade Iran with the idea that it will justify a draft.
Who's the they you're talking about, Scott?
Huh?
Who's the they you're talking about? I can see where actually some folks in the military may want there to be a draft, because that would put an end to Bush's war mania, because once you have a draft, you would have the people of America, you know, rise up against him. But I don't think that the Bush administration wants a draft at all. I think as long as they can get contractors, I mean, we've got 100,000 people making $150,000 a year in Iraq right now, these so-called contractors, not to mention the troops. And you know, as long as he can do this without anybody objecting, because their palms are sufficiently greased, he's going to keep doing it.
Well,
the draft is what put the end of the Vietnam War.
It did, but in their twisted way of thinking, they might actually have convinced themselves that they can convince the American people that they had no choice but to invade Iran.
Yeah.
And thereby warrant a draft.
Yeah, I agree with you that they have convinced themselves that they need to invade Iran and that's what they're going to do. And I think that they're doing it because Bush finds himself with his back into a corner. He's looking, Karl Rove is looking at going to jail. He's looking at impeachable offenses coming out. There's all these crimes of this administration that are on the verge of being revealed. Yesterday, you had Paul Bremer talking about how, 363 tons of $100 bills. I mean, we're talking enough money that you can see it from outer space that he just handed out, never got a receipt. Gee, where'd it go, Paul? I don't know, but I'm living pretty good. Paul Bremer, who was George Bush's roommate at Andover Prep School, by the way, billions of dollars missing, unaccountable for. I think that they're going to do it, but I think that they're going to do it so that we'll take our eye off the ball and these guys won't end up in jail, so there won't be prosecutions, but instead, so we'll be all tied up in a war and all preoccupied with that. But, we'll see. Scott, thank you for your call. Vic in Cedar Creek, Texas, also listening on Sirius. Hey, Vic.
Hi, Tom. Your last guest, that female congresswoman,
Barbara Lee.
Yeah, that was a great dialogue you had with her. And then you get down to the end, and I don't blame you because you know what's going on. She says, "Well, I have no idea why Bush crime family would do this." Mm-hmm. It's not a conspiracy theory. Everybody that listens to your show knows about the Project for the New American Century and the signatories to that thing, which included Jeb Bush, Crystal, Pearl. You talk about them daily.
Dick Cheney.
Why don't we bring this thing out? These guys are given...
But see, there are multiple pieces to this, Vic.
Taking over the world.
Yeah, there's multiple pieces to it. Yes, there's the PNAC and the neocons who think that we should become empire, and isn't that great that we're using the E-word again.
Right.
And then there's also these big defense companies who are huge donors to the Republican Party. There's the oil industry. I mean, look at what company just declared the biggest quarterly profit in the history of the galaxy, right? In the history of all of humankind, ExxonMobil.
They advocate the use of military power
right.
to achieve the goal. So,
most importantly, back in 1999, George Bush told Mickey Herskowitz, his biographer, that if he became president, he was going to invade Iran so that he could do away with Social Security, so that he'd have enough political capital that he could roll back the New Deal. So I think that there are multiple currents at work here. And yes, I agree with you, though, that we need to be pointing all of them out. Thank you, Vic, for doing so. Jeff in Wilmington, North Carolina. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, it's a pleasure to talk to you today.
Thank you, Jeff.
Yesterday, I don't know if you had a press conference with the Republicans, 80 that sent a letter to George Bush saying he needs to pardon the border security officer who got beat up in jail.
I didn't see that, but I'm quite familiar with it. And I know Lou Dobbs has been going off on it just on an almost daily basis.
Right. Where is the outrage from the conservatives that the Republicans in Congress said they would impeach the president if something else happened to that agent? In a time of war, doesn't it strike you as treasonous to mention impeaching the president? But the conservatives have no problem with a Republican.
Not if you're a conservative, right? Not if you're a Republican.
Yeah, the hypocrisy on this issue is it's mind-blowing.
Oh, yeah.
The talkers won't talk about it. I've tried to call 3 stations today and gotten through to their call screeners, and they won't talk about it.
The right-wing talkers.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, of course the right-wing talkers wouldn't talk about it. It's the hypocrisy of the right wing. And tragically, all the right-wing talk shows screen their callers to not put on people. Oddly enough, here we screen callers to put people on. If somebody calls and says, "I'm going to disagree with that Hartman guy," they go to the front of the line.
Right.
They're the first person I put on the air. And in fact, I'd appreciate it if more conservatives would call, because I love to have the debate. I think the discussion is a healthy thing for American democracy. But,
you would think.
Yeah. But the cons, they don't believe that.
They
know that the only way that they can maintain and hold power is by essentially lying to us. And good on you, Jeff, for pointing it out. Thank you very much. Art, driving in Florida. Hey, Art, what's on your mind today?
Hi, well, it's a pleasure to meet you. My comment is, if we go to war with Iran, is what will this do to the gas prices? Because we're on a very weak economy as it is. And the second point of that is we owe China and probably Saudi Arabia trillions of dollars, all they have to do is pull the rug out from under us and say, we can't afford the war, we want our money back, and we're screwed.
Yeah, yeah, and what you've talked about are really apples and oranges, but they're both fruit, you know. I mean, we have to worry about both of them. And if we go to war with Iran, in my opinion, Iran will probably shut down the Gulf of Hormuz. If they shut down the Gulf of Hormuz, 40% of the world's oil stops flowing. If 40% of the world's oil stops flowing, the price of oil is going to go not just to $100 a barrel, but probably to $200 a barrel, which according to Newt Gingrich is what Osama bin Laden said it should be at, and, you know, back before 9/11. When he said he was going to strike us if we continue to support a corrupt Saudi regime that was holding down the price of oil.
And how do we afford to pay for it? How do we afford to pay for it? We are in debt already.
Well, and not only that, how do you afford to pay for it with a dollar that becomes worth less and less and less?
Nothing.
Yeah, it's you're going to see hyperinflation like we, you know, like the Germans saw in the late 1920s, early 1930s. This could be an absolute disaster scenario, Art, and that's what the people were saying yesterday in front of Barbara Lee's hearing. And we need to be speaking out. We need to be speaking out to our members of Congress and saying, no, stop this guy and stop him now. Jim in Michigan, hey, listening on WTKG. Hey, Jim, welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Jim?
Hey, I heard you have Senator Webb on there a minute ago, and he was
yes.
talking about carriers in the Persian Gulf. I remember we had six carriers in the Gulf during the war, but he's right about during the Reagan era.
Yes.
What I learned when I was in the war over there on a carrier, there are mines in there and floating in the Persian Gulf from World War II, British mines,
yeah.
that even Princess D was aware of.
Yeah, it is not the safest places.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. We yeah. exploded two of them from my carrier.
So, oh, really? In 91?
Yeah, 91,
Yeah, amazing. So Bush is going to... So that's all it would take, really, is for one of the ships. It needn't even be a carrier. It could be one of the accompanying warships, or even... It could even be a dinghy that they're taking out to, you know, to move supplies from one boat to another or something, hitting a mine, blowing up, and boom, you've got it's the USS Maine all over again. What McKinley used as the excuse to start the Spanish-American War. Off you go. We're off to the races. Incredible. Jim, thank you for the call.
Tom,
Kevin,
may I ask you a question?
Yeah, sure.
In the Grand Rapids Press, Tom Tiepen was running an article about an executive order Bush issued about a political overseer. Have you heard anything about that?
Yes, the executive order, and we talked about it a couple days ago. The executive order says that every federal agency, agencies within the executive branch, which are created by Congress and have to do what Congress tells them to do, you know, like the Environmental Protection Agency, for example, will have a political appointee who is answerable to Bush, who is the filter through which everything has to go. So in other words, Bush is seizing control of all these agencies that have been created by Congress. It's wrong, it's unconstitutional, and it looks like he's going to pull it off.
Thanks very much. I'm usually getting ready for work at this time.
Yeah, no problem. You're welcome, Jim, and thanks for the call. And hopefully he can be stopped in that, too. I mean, it's a variation on the signing statements. This is King George all over again. 45 minutes past the hour. And welcome back to News Without Conflicts of Global Corporate Interest, the Tom Hartman radio program, 48 minutes past the hour, 49 minutes. Wait, the clock on this computer is going nuts. It's 10 minutes, coming up 9.5 minutes before the hour. Gary in Evansville, Indiana. Hey, Gary, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how are you doing today?
I am fine, Gary.
Good.
What's
I'm
up?
Praying for you.
Thank you.
I have a problem here that I need some help probably on the national level, and you're the first man I thought of.
Okay.
I operate the truck, so naturally I have to spend time in truck stops.
Yes, sir.
All the Flying J truck stops across the United States have had a change in corporate policy, and the only thing that they put on their television sets in there, which is in the driver's lounge, the restaurant, the break room, the store, everything, is Fox News.
Oh, man.
I called and complained about that, and I was told, in fact, just 10 minutes ago that is corporate policy.
Right. Yeah.
And he wanted to know why I was so adamant about getting that off of there. And I listed several reasons. One of them, the fact that I'm a decorated Vietnam veteran, and I don't like turning on a TV set and somebody calls me a traitor or treasonous because I don't agree with the certain policies, you know, that are going on.
Yeah. I think the point to make is there's two things going on here, Gary. The first is, my guess is probably corporate is responding to pressure that they're getting from some right-wing truckers who are advocates for Fox News. The problem is that Fox News is not a news channel. It's an advocacy channel. Just like this program is not a news program, it's an advocacy program. I've got a point of view. I'm pretty honest about it. Fox is not. They call themselves fair and balanced. Everybody knows, though. You know, the wink, wink, nod, nod. And so, you know, just like if you know, all the Sirius listeners were to call Sirius, or if all the listeners of any radio station were to call that radio station and say, hey, we want, you know, Hartman, or we want, you know, whatever, then that, you know, they have to take it seriously. They have to respond to that. And so if all the truckers, or a lot of truckers, if Fox got a lot of truckers calling into the truck stop company saying we want Fox News, then, you know, you're going to get Fox News. And the problem is that there aren't any other channels, any other TV channels that are advocacy channels. CNN is just straight news. MSNBC is actually kind of halfway in between. It's sort of half right wing, half, you know, well, even CNN now, they got Glenn Beck on there, they're half right wing. But, you know, the argument that I would make is that, you know, I want news, not advocacy, not a position, you know, put on one of the major networks or put on CNN. But what you're going to have to do is just get as many truckers as possible to call in. And there's a whole bunch of you listening right now, I know, to this program because we're carried live on Sirius here in this first hour. So I think you just got your message out, Gary.
Well, it's I mentioned CNN, and it doesn't have to be there. I noticed that they've swung a little bit, too. But
yeah.
However, it is much better news than what Fox touts itself to be.
Oh, yeah. Fox, I mean, you know, Glenn Beck, of course, puts a spin on all the news, but he only does that for an hour. Fox does it every single hour, 24 hours a day.
Well, I was told that CNN is too graphic, and I told him, I said, well, if you're talking about the blood that they show and the bombing sometimes, I said, war is not a pretty thing.
Yeah.
And that is an actual fact.
Yeah.
And you remember whenever we started getting the protest against Vietnam, nothing happened until whenever the government was controlling the news like these people are.
Yep.
When they started showing on open news channels, the coffin's coming home.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're spot on, right, Gary. I've got to move along to other calls, but you made your point. And
thank you so much for helping. I'm on the call with Schultz this afternoon too.
Okay, good. Yeah, get the word out all the way across as far and wide as you can. The people need to be calling truck stops and getting active there. Thanks a lot for the call, Dave in Eureka, California. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Oh, Tom, I wanted to bring up in addition to Barbara Lee's HR 770 there, that SAMFAR's 413 is a measure that would rescind any war powers that Bush may feel has been granted to him.
Is it 413?
413, yeah.
Okay. Great.
And incidentally, another point is I don't see you as an advocacy group in the sense that Fox is. Fox twists and lies to us about everything. You're a pretty honest, straightforward kind of a guy. I think if you found your side to be in the wrong, you would confront it. They won't. They'll twist it. So.
Well, I thank you, Dave, and I hope that that's the case. I try to make that the case here on the station, but my point is that, you know, we're both taking political positions. They may be doing it with less integrity, you know, hopefully than I do. But point made. Thank you very much, Pam in Redmond, Washington. Hey, Pam, welcome to the program. My computer just locked up. There we go, Pam.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Just wanted to thank you, first of all, for being, as that gentleman was saying, so honest and so actually so upbeat and encouraging us to do something and not just kind of raining down totally on.
We cannot despair, Pam. We cannot despair. We have to convert all of these emotions into activism.
I agree with you. I mean, I get angry, but then I put my anger into action, and I think that's absolutely, we have to do that, or we'll just.
That's great.
You know,
did you want to? You also want to make a point because we only have 30 seconds before the hour is over.
Oh, okay. Under Article 25, I believe it is, there's a provision for removing the president with for physical health reasons.
This is the 25th Amendment to the Constitution.
Yeah. And I...
It actually suggests or implies that you could even remove him if he's nuts.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. Why can't we use that to remove him? Because obviously there is something going on that's wrong in his head.
Yeah.
And I was looking at the Truth Out article by Briggs and Briggs.
Yeah. We've discussed it on the program before. We'll get into it again, Pam. The problem with using the 25th Amendment of the Constitution is that it requires Congress to go through this whole thing. The vice president has to sign off on it. It's really not the way to go. What we need to do is expose the crimes of this administration, and then it'll be obvious what needs to be done, I think, rather than trying to go around the back door. But it's a good idea. I appreciate the call. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Who was the greatest president? By the way, our quote for the day from Franklin Delano Roosevelt, "The test of our progress is not whether we add more to the abundance of those who have much. It is whether we provide enough for those who have too little." John Patrick Diggins is with us. He's the author of a new book, Ronald Reagan, Fate, Freedom, and the Making of History, published by W.W. Norton and Company. WWNorton.com is their website, but you can find the book in bookstores all over the country. John Patrick Diggins, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
I take it from spending some time with your book here that you're a big fan of Ronald Reagan's.
Well, I wasn't at the beginning years ago, and my younger years in California when he was governor, a lot of us thought he was the problem rather than the solution. But in my last 7 or 8 years, I've come to admire him greatly.
I'm baffled. Here's the guy who is the first president in the history of the United States to spend more money in 8 years than what had been spent in the prior 50 years. He was the first to cut taxes by more than 60% for his richest buddies. He was the first to increase the national debt faster than the growth of national income. He was the first to almost triple the national debt. He ran up more debt than all presidents combined before him. He ran up the national debt faster than the growth of GDP. He was the first to double the deficit. He was the first to turn America into a debtor nation. Actually, you could argue George Washington did, but that was remedied by John Adams soon thereafter. He was the first to have real interest rates of 8% after averaging over just about 1% for 35 years. I mean, he wrecked this country.
No, actually, the interest rates went down. I mean, you're right about some of your statistics there, but the interest rates were very high, and inflation was very high under Jimmy Carter, and Reagan's policy brought those down. But you're right about the spending.
I would submit to you that Carter's policies brought those down. I mean, that was Paul Volcker.
Well, Volcker also worked with Reagan, too.
Right, my point. This wasn't actually, arguably, it wasn't Carter or Reagan. It was the Fed. And what was happening was we had high interest rates because Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon tried to have it both ways. They wanted guns and butter. They wanted Johnson wanted his Great Society, and he wanted his war in Vietnam. And the only way to fund it was to borrow like crazy. And that borrowing and spending then led to ultimately the decision by the Fed apparently to crank up M3 and pay off those debts with less valuable dollars, and thus we had inflation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it took a while to wring that out. I mean, that the good of it and the bad of it had nothing to do with either president. But then Reagan did the same thing. He did the same thing that Nixon had done, only there wasn't even a war. He runs up this huge debt, handing all this money to these companies that were associated with Caspar Weinberger and George Shultz, and in large part, and Don Rumsfeld, you know, these huge defense contractors. And this year, you and I are going to spend a share of our tax dollars to the tune of $160 billion just on the interest on the debt that Ronald Reagan ran up. How can you call him a great president?
No. The debt was, you're right, the debt was extremely high, but my disappointment with Reagan is once the Cold War was coming to an end, there was no cutback in military expenditures, plus that he gave in to agricultural subsidies and other matters. Now, that's been continued, and in my book, I argue that what was called the original sin of liberalism and the Democratic Party became the perpetual curse of conservatism and the Republican Party. That is, I agree with you. That
you're talking about deficit spending.
Yeah, I mean, but
that wasn't, you know, John. We're talking with John Patrick Diggins. He's the author of Ronald Reagan: Fate, Freedom, and the Making of History. The deficit spending that Republicans railed against with Franklin Roosevelt.
Right.
Was deficit spending on domestic programs to put people back to work.
Right.
You know, it was taking,
right.
It was borrowing money. Well, actually, he also borrowed money to fight World War II. But primarily, what the Republicans were all upset about in the 30s, in the late 30s, was he was taking money and he was giving it to the average working guy so that the average working guy could actually have a job. The CCC,
right.
The WPA,
right.
And that stimulated the economy and brought us out of the Great Depression. Reagan, on the other hand, borrowed money and gave it to huge multinational corporations. Very little of it trickled down, and yeah, it stimulated the economy, sort of, but not. I mean,
right.
it wasn't at all what liberals would have done.
Right, and liberals under Roosevelt and Truman, and to a certain extent Eisenhower, although he's a Republican, they kept taxes high and progressive,
yes.
Whereas the Republicans wanted to increase spending and reduce taxes, and that led to a tremendous imbalance. I'm there with you on that. That's in my book. I mean, I praise mm-hmm. him as a great president, not because of economic policy. It's
okay,
supply,
then what am I missing? What made him great?
Oh,
he screwed up our economy, you know, which seems pretty important.
It's the foreign policy. I mean, he was able to get along with Gorbachev and Margaret Thatcher, to go to summit meetings, to be patient, to engage in dialogue. He was a great negotiator, and it's because of his leadership that we had disarmament treaties, and that the Cold War came to an end and communism collapsed. That's unprecedented in history.
You were not reading. You haven't looked back at the CIA reports during Jimmy Carter's presidency, or for that matter during Nixon's presidency. The CIA had been predicting the collapse of the Soviet Union for a full 50 years.
No. I'm sorry. You're wrong.
It was rotting from within.
The CIA. Daniel Patrick Moynihan had asked the CIA to look into why they had no expectation at all that the Soviet Union was going to collapse. I don't know where you get that information, but the CIA thought the economy was strong. This is just preposterous. And there's only two or three people who knew that was not the case. A couple of Europeans in our country, Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan. He gave a talk in 1984, even before Gorbachev came into office, saying that the Cold War is over, the Soviet Union is collapsing, we just have to wait it out. And sure enough, it happens.
Yeah, all you had to do is go and look at it. I mean, I was there when it was the Soviet Union, and it was obvious it was collapsing from within. This had nothing to do with Ronald Reagan. It was, and in fact, for that matter, it didn't collapse under Reagan. It collapsed under George Bush Sr.
No. The whole process started with Reagan. I mean
the whole process started with Harry Truman and his program of containment.
Not at all. I don't think it started at all, because containment didn't work. What did it do?
Containment led to the collapse of the Soviet Union.
How?
By preventing war with them, and on the other hand, letting them run out their economic policies that were nuts and didn't work until it just, you know, it ran out.
What is it you think led to the collapse of the Soviet Union?
The fact that the state being the purveyor of goods and services, the state being the state-run industries don't work. I'm a capitalist in that context.
Right. Well,
Communism economically did not work, and it was obvious by the time of the Eisenhower administration. It was incredibly obvious by the time of the Johnson and Nixon administration. Although everybody was freaking out, you had Don Rumsfeld creating during the Ford administration, creating the Committee for the Present Danger to whip up fear, saying that the Soviets had weapons of mass destruction that we didn't know about, submarines that were undetectable. CIA said he was wrong. Turned out the CIA was right and Rumsfeld was wrong. But, I mean...
No, that report, by the way, was called Team B.
Yeah,
and
Plan
the team,
yeah.
The team B.
Paul Wolfowitz headed it up.
Right. Well, the Team B was organized, allowed to get organized by Jerry Ford.
Right.
And the Team B was supposed to offer an alternative view than the CIA. And you're right, the CIA was a little bit more cautious in the Team B people, which were in office advising Bush today. They were very alarmist.
Yeah.
But in terms of the Soviet economy being weak, that was all goes all the way back to the 20s and under Lenin. It was always weak and vulnerable. But I would just ask you to use your imagination and try to remember what happened in Eastern Europe. It was the young people, the intellectuals, dissidents, and the factory workers, shipyard workers in Poland. They're the ones who...
I was there. I was in Budapest the week that the people started streaming in from East Germany, you know, just before the wall fell. Yes, I saw it, but it was everybody knew that the communism was collapsing. I mean, it was...
Right,
it was,
but why do you think it was allowed to collapse?
Because it was inevitable. You mean why did we allow it to collapse?
No.
Why did they allow it? Well, Gorbachev figured this out. I mean, he looked around and said, hey, this isn't working.
Well, he also renounces the Brezhnev doctrine, and that's the turning point. That's the whole turning point. Because
but Reagan had nothing to do with that. That was the wisdom of Gorbachev, not Reagan.
I didn't know I was going to get any argument midday. But listen, but the reason Gorbachev could do that is because he had the trust of Reagan. That was very important.
Okay, I'll give him that. The book Ronald Reagan, Fate, Freedom, and the Making of History, John Patrick Diggins. Check it out. John, thank you for being with us today.
Okay.
Good talk with you. 16 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466-440-THOM. And I mentioned that when people who want to disagree with me call, they go to the front of the line, and four of them, good heavens, called. So let's take their calls. Rick in St. Joe, Michigan. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tom, your ads are a bit disheartening that when I'm on hold here, calling Bush a liar. I remember specifically, thanks for taking my call, by the way.
You're welcome.
I remember Clinton talking about the ideology of Saddam Hussein and how evil they were in the chemical and nuclear and biological weapons. And
oh, sure, but Clinton didn't go to war with him.
Oh, he bombed him, Tom.
Clinton did not go to war with Saddam Hussein.
What was Firefox, Tom? What was Firefox?
We did not commit.
How many?
We did not. Rick, how many American soldiers died in Iraq with Clinton?
You know, Tom.
No, it's a simple question, Rick.
Why did 9/11 happen? I'm going to ask you a specific question. Why did 9/11 happen? Is it because Clinton sent 456 cruise missiles into Iraq and made them mad, or do we need to change their ideology?
Well, okay, good question. Why did 9/11 happen?
Yeah, I wanted to answer that.
Did you read Osama bin Laden's statement that was published in the New York Times about 3 years before 9/11 about how this was going to happen and why?
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm serious. Did you read it?
You've got to be kidding me.
It was published in the New York Times. Osama bin Laden said that we had left troops stationed in Saudi Arabia as a result of the 1991, the Gulf War, and that they were defiling Saudi soil, number one, and number two, that we were supporting a corrupt regime in Saudi Arabia that was keeping the price of oil low to the benefit of the United States. And he felt that those two things were crimes against his motherland, against his homeland, against the holy core land of Islam. He went after the Afghan war. Osama bin Laden went back to Saudi Arabia, pulled together a ragtag little army of, self-made army that he funded with his own millions, and went to the Iraqi border to try to invade Iraq and topple Saddam Hussein. That's how much he hated the fact that women were able to go to college and people were drinking alcohol in the streets of Iraq. He hated Saddam Hussein. For that crime, The country of Saudi Arabia deported him to Somalia, which is where his mother was from. Here he is stuck in Somalia. And at this point, he starts getting really upset with the Saudi regime and us for supporting them. And he issues this statement saying, I'm going to come and get you guys if you keep supporting the Saudis and if you keep American troops on Saudi soil. George W. Bush now has pulled those American troops off Saudi soil, and the price of oil has gone up. Osama bin Laden got exactly what he wanted, and apparently so did George W. Bush.
I'm just amazed.
Tell me what I'm missing here, Rick.
It's because of people like Saddam Hussein and Jong Il Kim in Korea.
Wait a minute. What did Saddam Hussein have to do with 9/11?
We handled this with diplomacy. It really worked well in North Korea under Carter's regime, who you love. I mean, give me a break. I mean, these people, the ideology of these people is absolutely ridiculous.
Rick, you're obviously not old enough to remember the Korean War.
Pardon?
You're obviously not old enough to remember the Korean War.
No, but my dad was in the Marines of the Vietnam. He jumped out of helicopters. I understand war, okay? He's shot 2 times, and I understand war. But I just don't like the disrespect you give to a president, and you call him a war criminal and a liar when everybody said the same thing.
No, they
John
weren't.
John Kerry,
Bill they were
Clinton,
not. They
Al
were not.
Gore.
None of those people were saying it's time to invade. Why did we go to war with Iraq? Real simple question. Just a real simple question. Why did we go to war in Iraq? Rick.
Why did we go to a war in Iraq?
Yes. Why did we invade a sovereign nation with 35 million people?
They were not a sovereign nation.
Iraq was not a sovereign nation?
Okay. Because in Clinton's own words, they harbored, Bill Clinton's old words, not taken out of context. They harbor terrorists. They train terrorists. They fund terrorism. They have chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. So let me just shove some cruise missiles down their throat.
Clinton says this, and so then, as a consequence of that, let me finish the sentence here, Rick. Let me just finish the sentence. Rick, I'm going to put you on hold for a second. As a consequence of that, the United Nations, and, you know, God bless him for doing it. Colin Powell had to shove it down George Bush's throat, send inspectors into Iraq to look for these weapons. And Hans Blix says, we got nothing.
That they were sort of willfully and consciously lying, but I think that they wanted to jump to conclusions.
He's talking about the Bush administration.
On deception?
Sorry, what?
In December 16th, 1998, he said it to the American people that they...
Absolutely. And that's why we got inspectors in there. That's why we were blockading, essentially, Iraq. And it was working. Saddam Hussein was in a box. He was working on a love novel. The guy was writing a romance novel.
They're at their border with 100,000 troops. Give me a break. I mean,
Saddam Hussein.
That's why
Rick, if you want to do dueling quotes, Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice, both of them in February of 2001, after George W. Bush was appointed president, both of them said Saddam Hussein is in a box and represents no threat to the United States.
Well, Tom, you need to quit calling our president a liar. Then you call Bill Clinton a liar, and you call everyone else.
Well, obviously, Bill Clinton lied about having sex. I'll stop calling George Bush a liar when he stops lying, Rick. Thanks for the call. 27 minutes past the hour.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Indeed. Welcome back. It's the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466. Jim in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Jim.
Good afternoon, Tom. Thank you, sir, for your good work. And the gentleman you were talking, a couple of gentlemen, I guess Rick seemed to just flip out on you there. I guess I believe he must be afflicted with the same denial problem that some of our neocons have.
Well, it's one of the good reasons why Fox News shouldn't be in every truck stop in America.
Absolutely.
When you ask Fox News listeners if they thought the weapons of mass destruction had been found in Iraq, some 70% of them said yes. And when you asked everybody else, only like 15% of Americans said yes.
Right. And then my other point was the gentleman you were talking about, I guess Reagan. I guess a lot of folks always consider Reagan to be a saint, but I've always felt that the man was duplicitous. I mean, he, in reality, he was really trying to dismantle, I believe, the middle class of this country. I mean, one of his main objectives was to destroy the Small Business Administration. Because that's where all the, you know, the money's going more to the big corporations than it is actually to the small business.
Well, it is now. It has been since Reagan. Before Reagan, it was actually going to small businesses.
Right, exactly.
He completely recalibrated it. And it stayed that way.
Exactly.
And I can tell you, because back in the 70s, I actually tried to get a Small Business Administration loan once. You know, as a, I have some familiarity with that. Yeah, I wasn't successful, but I've been there.
Well, it's just a shame, you know, that they say the things that you know, people want to hear, but in reality they're doing the opposite. And we need folks like you to, you know, keep us abreast of what's really going on. Thank
you. I will do my best, Jim. Okay. Thank you very much for the call. Thanks, and thanks for listening to KTRC. Mike in Mount Vernon, Illinois. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Greg. You're good. I love your show. This is the point. I've been trying to get on your show now for a while, and I just think that maybe you're a little critical there of old Mother Russia.
What do you
mean? That, because I had been theorizing that perhaps it was more so the marginalization and ostracization from global trade that really was their downfall. And I was thinking, you know, what if Great Britain or France had marginalized themselves from the world the way Soviet Russia had?
Because
forbidden trade and the exchange of technologies and things.
But the Soviet Union was more than willing to trade with other people. It's just nobody wanted to buy, you know, shoes where all the shoes looked the same. Nobody wanted to buy a car where every single car was identical. You know, in East Germany, you could buy any car you wanted as long as it was a black Trebby. That was it. It's like nobody wanted to buy Russian products. That's why there wasn't any trade with Russia.
Well, by the time, the history of the relationship was so hostile that maybe they were, you know, they were working with basically all that they had. I mean, Sputnik and all, they put their space program together with slide rulers.
I know. They had a lot of things that were held together with spit and baling wire. I'll tell you, the first time I was in Moscow, the hotel that we stayed at, which was the official hotel that they put you up in near the airport, I think it was called the Aeroflot Hotel, you know, where they've got microphones in every room and all that kind of stuff. We stayed on the third floor. Louise and I stayed on the third floor, and the elevator didn't work on the third floor. So we had to take the elevator up to the fourth floor and then run down the stairs to the third floor if we were going up. And then if we were going down, we had to go down the stairs to the second floor to get to the elevator to take it to the first floor, or just take the stairs all the way down. You know, it had been that way for years. I mean, literally years. The hotel had signs about the elevator that were yellow from age. That was what the Soviet Union was like, in the years before it collapsed. And frankly, the years after it collapsed.
Well, from the very get-go, though, especially the Western powers, there was just this great amount of fear and distrust of having the state-run enterprise with the communist scare.
Well, you had all these capitalists who actually thought that it represented a threat to capitalism, and in fact it didn't. I mean, they should have seen it for what it was, and they whipped up all this fear. I don't disagree with you on that, Mike, that, you know, that there was a lot of terror and fear and concern and all that kind of thing. But I'm telling you, if the Soviet Union had succeeded in making transistor radios better than the Japanese had, who we fought against in World War II, and there was a lot of anti-Japanese sentiment in the United States in the 1950s. I mean, it was really, really strong. In fact, in the late 40s, Japan renamed one of their cities, USA, USA, so that they could print on the goods that they were making to ship to the United States, made in USA, so that people in America would buy them. Because people, you know, in the late 40s and early 50s, people were refusing to buy things made in Japan. If the Soviets had made things as well as the Japanese had made things, there's no doubt in my mind that they would have found a good market here. But they didn't, because they didn't embrace even a regulated form of capitalism like Franklin Roosevelt did and ultimately Truman and Eisenhower. Mike, I've got to move along, but, you know, it's I guess we'll have to agree to disagree. Neil, Lauren here says you disagree with me. I'm going through my disagree calls here. Neil and Kirkland, Washington.
If you say so, just a couple of points briefly, Tom.
Sure.
You mentioned that when a person raises their right hand to serve active duty, they make a pledge to the Constitution. They do. But in my case, in 82, I raised my right hand and was active duty as a medic for 3 years. And the pledge was also to the commander-in-chief, who was at the time Ronald Reagan.
Yes, you're right. I stand corrected. I said that a couple of weeks ago, and and somebody sent me a copy of the actual pledge that folks in the military take, and it's different than the pledge that the president takes.
But as for your guest comments, you know, listen, if a person thinks that it was all truth in the 80s, I beg to differ. It was a wall of disinformation during the 80s. I was stationed at an Air Force hospital in Wiesbaden in 82, and I was there when the Marines came up from Lebanon. So as for Rick's comments, you know, it's easy to say, oh, my dad was in the military. But when you see the cost of war, when you see the maimed and the dead, it's quite another story. It sounds nice on paper, but, you know, for your guests' comments, I mean, I would drive back and forth to this hospital, and I would hear on the BBC. I didn't listen to AFN. I listened to the BBC. The BBC said that Reagan was spending well over $1 billion, which was huge cash money then, supporting the Taliban. They gave it to Osama bin Laden to build Tora Bora, for heaven's sake.
Sure.
And people want to gloss
over. In order to bleed the Russians, the Soviets.
You know, as for your great love for Germany, there are many of us, like I was a family member of a civilian who lived over there around the military community, and all around America now you will find people who were family members of active duty service people, and a lot of us have a great love for our families, our parents, others who've served active duty, and at the same time, we resist. We remember the words of Sophie Scholl, who says, you know, then we will not forget. We will not be silent.
Sophie Scholl of the White Rose Society.
Absolutely. Yeah. I lived in Munich for 3 years. So, you know, I just will never forget these things, being active duty. That most men who serve active duty do not, well, most men and women, they are not, most warriors are not the killers. Most warriors are men of peace. Listen to John Abizade, one of the smartest minds in the military.
Look at Dwight Eisenhower. He ran on a platform that he was going to end the Korean War, and he did, and he kept us in peace all that time that he was president, and he talked about peace every single chance he got. Neil, I've got to move along, but I appreciate your call and your sentiments. Thank you very much and for setting me straight on the military oath. Will in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Will.
Hey, Hartman.
So what's up?
Boy, do I have a bone to pick with you.
Okay, great. Here I am.
I want a piece of you, man. First of all, I'd like to thank you very much for bringing... I did not know that you... You're the only one that put it out on the information that a young man from Iraq who was refused medical care at the Minnesota VA...
Oh, who committed suicide.
And he committed suicide.
Yeah, but it was a tragedy.
I listened to
he's not the only one, by the way.
By the way,
he's just the most recent and one of the few that actually got reported in somewhat in the mainstream media. I think the Associated Press picked it up. I don't think most newspapers carried the story though.
Hey Hartman, I want to say thank you for bringing that to our attention. Believe you me, that is so tragic.
You're welcome. Now, what's the bone you have to pick with me, Will?
You know.
Hello.
Yes. I have a hard time attacking people. Reagan was the worst president. When Reagan was elected, I was in...
Will, you keep agreeing with me. I'm going to move along to the next guy who's upset with me. In fact, I'm going to have to do that right now. Will, thanks for the call. I appreciate it, but you know we're running out of time here. Doug in is it Hummel, California, Doug?
Hummel, can you hear me?
Hummel, yeah, I can hear you just fine. Welcome to the program.
Now, you know, Tom, you're great. Great for taking my call, but I'm going to listen to you because I really want to hear your opinion on this because I haven't think you've talked about it enough, and that is the false imprisonment of the border agents Ramon and Campion, who are Hispanic, and that they're falsely imprisoned
I think it's a crime. I agree with you, Doug, and I agree with Lou Dobbs on that. You know, these guys are being made scapegoats.
Then why aren't you asking your listeners to call the White House and demand a release now? And why not jump on the bandwagon with conservatives like me that want Bush impeached for doing this to these border agents? Because you're going to find out that Attorney Johnny Sutton is taking orders from Bush, and that his responsibility, Bush's responsibility, this open border is against the Constitution, and you really have a legitimate
right
now. I agree with you,
Doug. Impeach Bush on the border.
Yeah, among other things. Among other things. How about, you know, other areas where conservatives probably agree with me? The loss of habeas corpus. How about the loss of our rights? How about the end of posse comitatus? I mean, there's a lot of things that I think that conservatives like yourself would agree with me that Bush has committed impeachable crimes.
Yes, but this border issue with these agents, the agents got beat up in prison.
Yeah.
My God.
No, I'm right there with you, and I agree. People should call the White House, and they should demand that Bush pardon these guys. Absolutely. Thank you, Doug. 45 minutes past the hour.
Look at us, we're beautiful. All the people push and pull by. Let's just go out and ride. Talk about the things we tried. Look at us, we're beautiful. All the people push and pull, but they'll never get inside. We've got too much to hide.
And welcome back. Yeah, they're not going to... Well, actually, I think what Bush is going to do in order to cover it all up is he's going to have himself another war. That's what he's going to do. And with regard to the border issue, I just want to just be on the record one more time in saying we don't have an illegal immigration problem in this, or an illegal immigrant problem in this country. It's not the human beings. It's the corporations. We have an illegal employer problem in the United States. And it's one that we need to confront because it's killing us. And so, anyhow, as we continue.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The liberal shadow knows.
So, another conservative wants to disagree with me, Sean in Rhode Island. Welcome to the program.
Yes, how you doing, Tom?
I'm fine. What's up, Sean?
I heard you on the internet, and you're talking all about, well, the basic Bush lied thing, and I'm kind of getting sick of it because he didn't lie. There were WMDs in Iraq. This should be obvious because just before the last election, the New York Times flashed the front page about leaking nuke plans on the web. Now, if there weren't any nuke plans, if there weren't any WMDs, then he couldn't leak them on the web.
I'm missing something here, Sean. What you just said doesn't make. I'm sorry, it doesn't compute.
Well, we captured a bunch of documents in Saddam's Oval Office and his IIS headquarters and various places all throughout.
Right. So he has documents.
Yes, and those documents were
now.
Giant translation program going on. The FBI basically farmed out the translations on the web so people could check out documents, translate them, and hand them.
Sean, don't you think that if any actual weapons of mass destruction had been found in Iraq, that George W. Bush would be walking around waving them at people? I mean, he has come out and said, no, we didn't find any weapons of mass destruction. He's come out and said it as recently as 5 months ago.
Well, 5 months ago, sure. This stuff hit the New York Times, what, in November? End of November? I don't know why he's not Trump. If I was him, I would be waving the flag.
You know, finding some plans is not something. Number one, it's not weapons of mass destruction. And number two, it's not a reason to invade another country, kill 500,000 people, lose 3,000 Americans, and spend more money than we spent on World War II.
Well, Craig, but it's not just weapons of mass destruction. I mean, there's other things in those documents. I mean, it describes how they were handed off to Syria. It describes the whole process, the trucks that were used to deliver them. It talks about biological chemical weapons, former WMD sites that weren't checked, all kinds of, I mean, there's all kinds of things in there. He thought he was still at war with us from the first Gulf War.
So, you're suggesting to me, it sounds to me like what you're trying to say is that George Bush was justified in attacking Iraq.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, if he was justified in attacking Iraq because Saddam Hussein had some documents, who else are we justified in attacking?
Oh, you could add the list, right? I mean, the axis of evil.
Okay, so we should attack Iran. We should attack North Korea.
The fact that he points out.
No, let's continue.
Mean you shouldn't take any of the weasels down.
Okay, so we should attack Iran. We should attack North Korea. Who else should we attack?
I don't know.
Saudi Arabia is talking about building a nuke. Pakistan already has a nuke, and it's a military dictatorship. And in fact, it's where Osama bin Laden happens to live. Maybe we should attack Pakistan. India refuses to sign the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, and they've got nukes illegally. Should we attack India? They have actual weapons of mass destruction.
Right.
So should we attack them?
Well, see, you try to think that because someone's a threat, you have to attack everybody on the list.
No, Sean, my point is that warfare is politics on steroids. War is not inseparable from politics. It is the ultimate statement of the failure of politics. but it is also the extreme end of politics. And long before you go to war, there's a whole bunch of other things you do to try and bring about change. And Bush didn't do any of those things because he wanted a war so badly, because as he told Mickey Herskowitz in 1999, his biographer and 25-year family friend, the guy who wrote A Charge to Keep, his autobiography in the bookstores, as he told him in 1999, and this is on the record, if I get an opportunity, well, here, this will make you crazy. Here's Cindy Sheehan reading it to John Conyers Commission.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
There you go.
Okay, but what is that? That really doesn't have any meaning or anything. Clinton.
Yeah, it does. Bush invaded Iraq because he wanted to get political capital.
Clinton wanted to take out Iraq, too.
No, he didn't.
Well, but no, he did. He signed the executive order ordering it.
Clinton thought that...
It was in 99, I believe, as well.
Clinton did not invade Iraq.
Well, no, he didn't have any, what am I looking for? I don't think method or opportunity, but he didn't have any...
Clinton was engaged in all those things that you do short of war to try to change a regime or try to reform a regime or try to bring people in the region together to bring pressure on a regime. There's so many things you do short of war. Don't you get it? A couple of 100,000 human beings, Sean, just like you and me, just like our kids and our parents and our brothers and sisters, are dead because this guy made a choice not to use reasonable and normal political action, but instead to use violent political action.
What happens, Tom, when you get to the end of the reasonable normal political action and nothing's been solved?
Well, it depends on what the problem is.
Well, no.
If the problem is Hitler, then you go in with guns. But if the problem is Saddam Hussein, you just keep pushing. You keep pushing and you keep pushing until his own people rise up and take him down.
Then there's a difference between Saddam Hussein and Hitler.
Oh, there's a huge difference.
What?
Hitler attacked all his neighbors, and Hitler declared war on us. Saddam Hussein was not declaring war on anybody. We beat him in Kuwait. There's massive differences. But, Sean, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. We're out of time here. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Harbin with you. Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. We'll be back with more of your calls and the news of the day right after the news at the top of the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Oh, man, what a day. Nancy Pelosi on her jet. This is absolutely nuts. The cons are trying to whip this into a huge thing. And there's no there there. I mean, it's like there's no there there. Hastert has this plane. After 9/11, the Department of Defense says to Hastert, you got to stop flying on commercial airplanes because you're number three, right? There's the president, the vice president, and then the next guy is the Speaker of the House. And so if that plane that was shot down in Pennsylvania really was heading for the White House, and if Bush had been in Washington and if it had taken out the president and vice president, Denny Hastert would have been president. So since you're number three, we're of the opinion that you should no longer fly in commercial aircraft. Now, you're a congressman. You got to go home every weekend or frequently and meet with your constituents and do your work. So we're going to provide you with a plane to take you home. Denny Hastert lived in Illinois. So they gave him a plane that had a range that would fly from Washington, D.C. to Illinois. Nancy Pelosi comes into office. She's always flown back and forth on commercial aircraft. She's, you know, a million miler now, you know. She always flew back and forth. And she comes in as Speaker of the House, and the sergeant at arms, the guy who's in charge of, like, kind of, you know, facilitating things, making things work, he comes to her and he says, you know, Denny Hastert was told by the Department of Defense he's supposed to fly in a private plane. And we've got this plane here that Denny Hastert's been using that you could use. The only problem is it only has a range of about 1,000 miles. You know, it'll get you to Chicago, but it won't get you to San Francisco, which is where you happen to live. So I can look into it. I can ask the Department of Defense if they can get you a larger plane. You know, one with a long enough range, and one that holds enough fuel that it'll fly you all the way to San Francisco. And Nancy Pelosi says that makes sense. You know, if I've got to fly on a military plane, I'd rather not stop in St. Louis for gas every time. And if, let me tell you, as a frequent flyer myself, I echo that sentiment. Make it a five-hour flight instead of an eight-hour flight. Sure, let's do it. And so he goes back and he says, hey, can we get her a bigger plane? And all of a sudden, all over the blogosphere and on Fox News and 6 days in a row on Lou Dobbs, you got all these people go, well, Nancy Pelosi's trying to get a 757, or Nancy Pelosi's trying to get a great big for her whole delegation and all her family and friends and everybody, they're going to make a party. Well, if you have a big enough plane to fly from Washington to California, then, you know, if it'll hold a few extra people, put them on it, what's the big deal? But beyond that, Denny Hastert was flying his staff back and forth on his plane. This is, as Nancy Pelosi has said repeatedly, this has nothing to do with the you know, the internal capacity of the airplane. Nothing to do with the size of the inside of the airplane. It's entirely about how far it will fly. But they are doing everything they can. Just to turn this into a Bill Clinton haircut incident. A lot of presidents have gotten a lot of haircuts on Air Force One or nearby, and Bill Clinton got one in Los Angeles once, and it did not tie up traffic at LAX. But the right-wing blogosphere got out there and said it did, and the right-wing talk show hosts got out there and said that Clinton's haircut tied up traffic at LAX. Actually, there was one plane that was delayed by about 10 minutes on taxi as a consequence of Bill Clinton's plane being there. One plane delayed 10 minutes. So there was like this little tiny germ of truth. And they turned it into this whole huge thing that even today most people believe, you know, one of these vanishing hitchhiker stories. Speaking of which, by the way, one of our listeners sent me a note, said the Made in USA story that I told during the last hour was not right. He says Snopes has debunked it. That was a story I remember my dad telling me when I was a little kid. I always assumed it was true. I'm sure he always assumed it was true. And I figured he would know. He had served in Japan for 2 years. But turns out it's a vanishing hitchhiker story also. So, speaking of all... Aha! Excuse me. I have the wrong folder here, David. Where did it go? Jane Hampshire is with us. And I don't have the information. Jane Hampshire, welcome to the program. You're the blogger who's been covering the Scooter Libby trial.
I am covering the Scooter Libby trial.
Yes, I'm sorry.
I just locked out Tim Russert's testimony to give you a call.
Yeah, I had known that you were calling, but the way that it just came in right now, I thought I had a pre-scheduled guest that I didn't have any paperwork on, and it caught me totally flat-footed. I'm sorry, Jane, to blank out like that on you. Thanks so much for calling us. I appreciate it. We reached out to you when I saw that you had been blogging over at Huffington Post and doing a great job talking about what's going on. Give us an update on what's happening with the Libby trial.
Well, today it's been all Tim Russert all day. Tim Russert started yesterday. And the first thing we were sort of greeted with that was a shock was the fact that even though Russert had fought appearing before the grand jury and telling them what he knew about his conversation with Scooter Libby, he had freely offered up all of this information to Jack Eckenrode, the FBI agent who originally interviewed him. Mm-hmm. So all the noise about protecting his, you know, the need to protect his journalistic sources was seemed like it might be kind of that noise.
Russert's?
Just a little.
Interesting, interesting. So, well, it was good PR for him, you know?
It wasn't good PR for him. It made him look like, you know, he was being a First Amendment hero. But when he was originally contacted by Eckenrode, that wasn't his first consideration.
Yeah.
So he fought going to appearing before the grand jury and, of course, appearing on behalf of the prosecution, lost and was here, and I think has been very sheepish about that.
Yeah, yeah. This is not going to make Tim Russert look good, but what does it do to Scooter Libby? I mean, basically, Russert is saying that Libby lied, right?
Well, that's the question everybody's asking. You know, the defense is spending a great deal of time trying to establish that, you know, he talked to Jack Eckenrode out of school, but that doesn't really establish that either he misremembered Libby's conversation or that he lied. The defense seems to be a bit all over the place. At first, they were trying to prove that Russert had a bad memory. Then they were trying to tie him to Andrea Mitchell. I think you'll recall at one point Andrea Mitchell said that she and a lot of the other Washington press corps knew that Joseph Wilson's wife worked for the CIA. Mm-hmm. And they were trying to prove that if Mitchell knew it, that Russert knew it, and therefore Russert was, you know, lying when he said that he had no knowledge during a Libby conversation about that.
Now, the question that all of this brings up for me, Jane, is that, you know, we keep hearing now that Libby learned this from Dick Cheney. And that's been, you know, there's so much testimony corroborating that it's pretty irrefutable, I'd say, at this point. Why did Patrick Fitzgerald not at the very least, say that there was a criminal conspiracy here and that Dick Cheney was an unindicted co-conspirator?
I don't think he can prove that yet. You know, it's like the mobster you get for tax evasion because you can't prove that he was bootlegging.
Yeah.
You know, they have to get past Libby's excuses. Libby's, you know, if in fact Libby is obfuscating, lying, they have to cut through those before he can prove what he needs to prove against anybody else.
Do you think that there's a possibility that what comes out of this Libby trial might lead to a prosecution of the vice president?
That's always been my feeling, that especially if he can get a conviction on Libby, and Libby is motivated to not spend the next 30 years of his life in jail, that he might get cooperation, much like you would any criminal conspiracy participant.
That's great. We're talking with Jane Hampshire, her website, firedoglake.com. You're the founder of Fire Dog Lake?
That would be me.
The blog spot, the blogging site, and how would you describe firedoglake.com?
It's a liberal blog, political blog site. We do a lot of stuff, but we focus a lot on the plane, the CIA leak investigation, and so this is kind of a real treat for us to be able to be here.
Yeah, and you're doing a very, very good job of keeping track of what's going on. We just have about a minute left, Jane. What, in summary, you know, what direction is this thing going? Where do you think how is this all going to shake out?
Well, today is the last day of the prosecution, and the defense will take up after this. I don't know where the defense is going to go. Right now, as I walked out of the room, Ted Wells is trying to prove that there was a conspiracy at NBC, you know, that they were taking such joy in Libby's indictment, that there was like some sort of conspiracy to assist in the indictment.
So you mean
I don't know where the defense is going.
You mean in his cross-examination of Tim Russert, he was asking questions implying that he believed that?
Yeah, they were actually playing tape of NBC on the day of Libby's indictment, saying that they were all really overjoyed that this was happening. And so I got to tell you, Tom, I don't know where this is going to go.
Gee, a news organization overjoyed that there's news being made. I mean, that's how they make their money. What do you expect? That's incredible. Jane Hampshire, FiredogLake.com. Thanks, Jane, for calling and giving us the update.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Place where smart people get their news. We'll be back with more news of the day and your calls right after this. Slightly unbalanced. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. Listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, listening to your local affiliates or your local station for their sponsors and supporting them and letting them know that you're listening, letting the stations know that you're listening, and also by our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, sacredgroundscoffee.com, all organic, all free trade, Small Dog Electronics, smalldog.com, latest iPods and all things Macintosh, the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, and Purina One Natural Blends, 866-380-MEOW, M-E-O-W. You know, some people don't know how to spell meow, M-E-O-W, yeah. So, anyway, welcome back. And we've just got the phone line slammed here. Let's get back to some of the conversations about the events of the day. Susan in Bennington, Vermont. Hey, Susan, welcome. Thanks for calling.
That guy who called in and said Bush didn't lie. That's all he's done was lie. He has not told the truth about anything.
Well, I think he's told the truth about a few things, but
I haven't heard any. Yeah. And I listen to him sometimes. Most of the time, I turn him off. Because I know it's going to be a lie that he's going to tell us.
He gave us the right name for his dog, I think.
And all the soldiers we've lost, all because we didn't have to go to this war.
Yeah. No, I spot on, Susan. We need to be calling it out. We need to just be calling that out. Thank you very much for calling us.
Thank you.
Jim in Everett, Washington. Hey, Jim.
Good morrow.
Hi.
Been a while, but I've been a hold here.
You have, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, one of the things that's just amazing is last Monday, Department of Defense released a series of photographs of weapons that they claim were Iranian weapons that had been captured in Iraq.
Right.
Four of the photos in the collage that were issued as posted on the ABC News website, which were, of course, recalled by DOD on Friday, showed a tube weapon system that goes on the Hunter unmanned aerial vehicle to dispense landmines.
Okay.
Okay. The other thing on the news that I don't know if most
What's your point, Jim, about that?
Oh, the Hunter UAV is a U.S. Army unmanned aerial vehicle.
Right.
Okay. If a weapon comes off a Hunter unmanned aerial vehicle, it is an American weapon. It is not an Iranian weapon.
I see.
Okay.
So you suspect a disinformation campaign?
Well, yeah. Okay. But more importantly, if you watch the news at night and you see the video of our soldiers in Iraq,
mm-hmm.
notice how many of them are not carrying their M16 or M4 issued firearm, but have instead traded that weapon for an AK-47.
I've never noticed that. I apparently, you've been paying attention. First of all, what's the significance of that? AK-47s are ubiquitous in Iraq. They're what all the
the
insurgencies.
All the Iraqi soldiers are issued AK-47s because there are so many of them. They're so cheap.
Right, right.
But we're issuing our troops bad ammunition, and the troops trade their M16 so that they aren't stuck with bad ammunition.
So the AK-47 uses a different round?
Right. The M16 uses a .223 caliber, and the AK-47 shoots 7.65 millimeter.
Interesting.
Okay. And
so what's the therefore to that? Is that we weren't prepared and so we're going to subgrade ammunition or we're importing it from someplace else? I understand that we're buying an awful lot of our ammunition from Israel right now because we can't manufacture enough of it.
China.
Ah, okay.
Okay.
Interesting.
This is one of these, you need to dig into it yourself because I'm not allowed to tell you things.
Okay.
But the other statement is, have you noticed how many of our 15 and 18-year service veterans have been quitting the military?
I've been noticing a startling number of generals quitting the military lately so that they could criticize Bush.
Look at the enlisted.
Yeah.
Okay, if you're enlisted, you get no more benefits if you quit after 16 years than if you quit after 4 years.
Oh, interesting.
Okay,
you have to
get 20 years.
Oh, I see.
Like
a minimum threshold for an enlisted person?
Right. Okay, and you know, a guy who's got 16 years in can hold his breath for 4 years.
Yeah, unless
he thinks he's going to die. But they're quitting rather than serve under Dumsfeld and this whole gang of crooks.
Yeah.
And you have to go back and look at the Tiger Team program in Vietnam, which Rumsfeld and Negroponte ran, and realized how badly these people hate our servicemen and women.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure hate. I think that more cynically are willing to cynically use to accomplish their goals. But, Jim, thank you for the call. It's, you know, a lot of good food for thought there. Boy. Yeah, cynically, at a certain point, when people think of soldiers as chess players, you know, on a board, there is a, for lack of a better word, there's a mental illness associated with that, which I think is very, very destructive. 27 minutes past the hour.
It was a beautiful day. Time beat down. I heard the radio walk. I was driving. Trees went by. Me and Del were singing. A little runaway. I was flying.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Okay, Nancy Pelosi now says she's going to fly commercial. The right wingers have made such a stink out of this. Screw it. I'll fly on United or whatever. You know, she's going to fly commercial rather than use the aircraft offered by the Pentagon. But in the meantime, and let's see if the right wing media picks up on this. The military airplane that Denny Hastert was using, that nobody seemed to complain or care about, Hastert was using to fly Foley Page scandal figures around on. Yep, Chicago Sun-Times. Sunday, October 1st, Hastert teams was scrambling to contain the escalating fallout from the Foley Page scandal. The Hastert team wanted Shimkus, this is John Shimkus, the congressman from Illinois, chairman of the Page board, to return to Washington immediately from his home in southern Illinois in order to appear at a press conference with the speaker. They didn't want to deal with a commercial flight schedule, so at 8 p.m. that day, Shimkus arrives at the military site of the Scott Air Force Base near Belleville to board the speaker's jet, etc. Think any right-wingers are going to be bloviating about that? Somehow I doubt it.
Somehow I doubt it.
Anyhow, 866-440-8466, our telephone number. Steve in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Steve.
Amazing. Hey, I just want to pick on the conservative callers earlier. I was a little disappointed. I thought they were going to bring something new to the table.
Well, but I keep hoping. I keep hoping.
Same old crap. Yeah. With those guys, I want to ask them two questions. I want to say, first of all, do you love your party more than your country? And secondly, I want to say, what would the president have to do for you to demand impeachment? You know, what would it take?
Yeah. And do you, and I half know the answer. He'd have to have sex with an intern and lie about it. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Good points you made. Charlie in Freeport, Pennsylvania. Hey, Charlie, you want to disagree with me? Go for it.
No, I'm not disagreeing with anything.
I've
been on the phone here for an hour, and I got to run anyway, but you are the light at the end of the tunnel. Don't get me wrong here.
Okay.
The back up there with Reagan. That guy, he couldn't have lived in the same planet, not on the same Earth. Reagan actually prolonged the Cold War, and I'll tell you how.
Okay.
When the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, Jimmy Carter right away was trying to boycott the Olympics. Cut the Olympics off. He had the biggest grain embargo we ever had against them. He had a high-tech transfer banned against them. And he had all that equipment for the Caspian Sea, that other pipeline, banned against them. Reagan wasn't in power 1 month and released all of that.
You know, you're absolutely right. I remember that happening.
Remember that?
Oh,
and
yeah.
Then, on top of that...
So Jimmy Carter would have brought down the Soviet Union if Reagan hadn't come into office.
That's right. And all he did was prolong, and he helped their economy, that damn right-wing garbage. But the thing of it is, Jimmy Carter never gets any of that. I'm no big Carter fan, but I'll tell you one thing. He had them hurting. They had to buy grain, if you remember, through third parties.
Yeah, you're right.
And any transfer, anything, any high tech at all went through anything.
In fact, Jimmy Carter was criticized for that by people who said that he was going to cause starvation in the Soviet Union.
Exactly. Reagan prolonged the Cold War. He never helped to bring down the wall.
Charlie, you're right. You're right.
The wall might have come down 2 years before that.
Yep, You're right. And in fact, it, as I said before, it came down during Bush's administration, not Reagan's. And why everybody wants to turn Reagan into the, you know, the great
oh,
lion of God.
Oh, God almighty. What he did to California, they should have hung him.
Yeah.
But
he,
back up just real quick here, because I've got to run anyway. I won't hold you up. But and then that guy brought up about the inflation. If you remember, the oil embargo, the tripling of the oil, price of oil, maybe it was only $6 a barrel. That's what really brought stagflation into this. Ford was tied up with it.
That was 72, 72, 73. Yep, although the price of oil did go back down. But, yeah, you're right. That had a big impact on it, too. Charlie, thank you very much. You're a student of history, and I appreciate your bringing it to the show.
Oh, God, thank God you're there.
And ditto. Keep up the great work, Charlie. Art in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Art, what's on your mind today?
Well, Tom, I have a pessimistic viewpoint, which you probably already thought of or may have expressed in the past. What my fear is that there's nothing we can do to stop the escalation into Iran, because I think that the United States economy doesn't run on oil. It runs on war.
To some extent right now, yeah.
And we have a continuing enemy, which according to the neocons, will continue, and that's the terrorists. We have a complete supply of fuel, U.S. lives of young men and young women, and we have a continuing supply of borrowed money. And we're now $10 trillion in debt, and we can continue to go into debt, because I don't think that the American public realizes how much we're in debt and who we're in debt to.
Right.
And the frightening thing is, and God, I hope I'm wrong, frightening thing is, if the economy of the United States runs on war, then Bush will do anything, and he has the complicity of his administration and the military and the media and at least half of the Senate and enough Democrats in the House that he can do anything he wants, like precipitating an incident. Like, for instance, if somehow or another a little so-called Iranian craft runs into the side and explodes against the side of a U.S. aircraft carrier, which is in the Gulf, this is the precipitating factor which enables the United States to continue to run on war.
Right.
And it scares the hell out of me.
Yeah. No, I don't disagree with you entirely, Art. And in fact, the point that I was making back during the Reagan era, when Reagan was president, was, you know, the cons toward the end of, I mean, there was a terrible, terrible recession during Reagan's time. But toward the end of his presidency, the economy was picking up a little. And everybody was saying, look at how wonderful the economy is. And I was saying, number one, he spent $1 trillion on SDI. I mean, he spent $1,000 billion on military that we didn't need. And number two, a fair amount of that money trickled back into the U.S. economy. Not anywhere close to what would have trickled back if he had taken that same amount of money and simply put people to work like Franklin Roosevelt did, you know, put it at the bottom rather than the top. But some of it did trickle back down into the economy, and it stimulated the economy. And I believe that if George Bush had not gone to war after 9/11, that and had continued his conservative economic policies, his tax cuts and all the other insanity that he's doing, that we would be in a very serious recession right now. That about the only thing that is keeping this country from recession is the fact that we are borrowing and spending hundreds of billions of dollars every year, in large part in Iraq, and that money is going through these private contractors and ending up back here in the United States. And some of it, you know, a good chunk of it. And that's, you know, the source of enough stimulus that Bush has any job growth at all, even though this is the most anemic recovery since the Great Depression. But,
right.
I don't disagree with you. And that's the tragedy of it. And we need to make that transition. We need to get unstuck from that.
My question is, I really don't know how, if we have a wavering Congress, even though I think every person like me as a Democrat should write a letter or send an email or make a phone call to the congressman or the senator representing us and say, if we had not wanted to change, we would have voted Republican.
Yeah.
Simple as that.
Yeah.
And then maybe the Democrats can get some spine and can unite against a war economy, because that's a frightening prospect. You're a historian.
Amen.
When was the last time that any nation depended on war in order to survive?
Well, the Roman Empire.
Well, that's scary.
You could argue that the Soviets, not so much. Art, good point. Thank you very much for the call. In fact, here's Dwight Eisenhower pointed this out in 1961, and he made a point that I think most Americans, particularly this generation of Americans, don't know. Here's Dwight Eisenhower talking about this.
Our military organization today bears little relation to that known of any of my predecessors in peacetime.
In other words, every president before him had a different kind of army than he has in 1961. Why?
Or indeed by the fighting men of World War II or Korea.
See, even when he was leading the troops in World War II, the military was different. How so?
Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry.
There you go. We had no armaments industry. You get this? This is from Eisenhower. This is the Republican president, his farewell speech.
American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well.
And that's what we did. We converted our automobile manufacturers into tank manufacturers and military truck manufacturers. We converted our commercial aircraft manufacturers into airplane, bomber manufacturers.
But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense.
So he says, now we've got a serious problem. However, this also brings with it some serious dangers.
Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society.
And then, of course, his famous military-industrial complex.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
And I would submit along with Art that it has. 45 minutes past the hour.
It just don't get any better than this.
No siree, Bob.
That's about as good as good ever gets.
Talking back to the mainstream media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Noon to 3 Eastern Time, 9 to noon Pacific Time. Tom Hartman here with you. And Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
What's happening in Washington, D.C. today? We got a report from a blogger over at FireDogLake.com from the Scooter Libby trial, so we've got the latest on that. What else is going on?
Well, this whole thing with Nancy Pelosi and the military jet thing is kind of interesting.
Yeah, well, now she said, screw it, I'm going to take commercial aircraft.
Right. She just doesn't want to know. Now, the White House kind of came to her defense. Tony Snow did.
Mm-hmm.
But when you've got to have the White House come to your defense and you're a Democrat, that tells you that there's something very wrong with
you. You're in trouble, yeah.
Yeah, and the story was pitched wrong from the very beginning. If she didn't seek this out, the sergeant-at-arms thought the whole thing out from the very beginning.
That's right, but the right-wingers have been trying to turn this into a Bill Clinton haircut on the L.A. tarmac story, and they're not going to let go.
No, absolutely not. I had Fox News on this morning in my studio, and it was all over it. So
You had Fox News on?
Well, I have them all on, you know.
Oh.
Yeah, I didn't have it on as a choice.
Yeah. Do you have a vaccine, or is there something? I mean, there must be.
I'm very strong.
I see. Or a good bottle of gin nearby.
Yeah, I know. It's a combination of gin and sheer willpower.
I don't know. Every now and then, Louise will say, "Well, we should watch Fox News and see what they're saying." And after about 10 minutes, I just have to walk out of the room. Anyhow, what's going on in Washington D.C.? Nancy Pelosi.
In addition to that, we've had this interesting situation in the Senate where, as you know, they voted, the Republicans voted not to have debate on the non-binding resolution.
Right.
And then last night, Senators Warner and Hagel and five others turned around wrote a letter to Senator Reid, the majority leader, and said, well, actually, what we intend to do is we intend to do every little parliamentary trick we possibly can to make sure that we do have debate on this resolution.
This is because I'm assuming these were the up for re-election in 2 years Republicans who are all of a sudden now moderates, so like Gordon Smith.
Combination of them, combination of the always moderates, people who, like Voinovich, tend to go his own way. He wanders the corridors doing his own thing.
Collins and...
Collins and Snow, Norm Coleman.
Norm Coleman, he's one of the up for re-election in 2 years and suddenly turning left, yeah.
Right.
He's scared to death of Al Franken, frankly.
And what's his name of, is it Oregon?
Yeah, Gordon Smith of Oregon.
Yep, Gordon Smith of Oregon. And then Warner and Hagel, who, of course, have the resolutions.
Right. Right. Now, 7 is not 11. And, well, actually, they only need 10 because Harry Reid had to vote no so that he could bring it up again. And it was 49. So with 7, they're at 57. That's still not enough to stop a filibuster.
No, it's not enough to stop a filibuster, but it shows that these people are realizing that this is playing very badly at home. That the way it's being shown is not so much that the way they hoped it would be played, but it's being shown as Republican obstructionism.
Yeah.
They tried to play it the other way as to show that the Democrats were trying to stifle debate, and that's not how it's come across.
Yeah, interesting. Victoria, let's take a couple calls together here.
Okay.
Steve in Monterey, California, you're on the air. What's up?
Hey, Tom?
Hey, Steve.
Thanks. I'd like to summarize Eisenhower as saying that in order to defeat the military machine of the Germans, we became worse than our enemy.
You know, this was, it's interesting because that's the conundrum that the Native Americans faced. And different tribes chose different ways, but they basically had three options. They could run away, which is what the Shoshone did, for example, because they had a large enough territory that they could do it. They could stay and fight and become the enemy,
right?
Because these are people who basically did not fight genocidal wars. They didn't fight to the death. The lacrosse was a Native American way of settling disputes. Or they could stand there and be slaughtered, which many of them chose to do. And it's a tough one.
Anyway, Tom, I, on the instigation of Democracy for America, I called both my waffling and my solid Democratic senators out here in California and encouraged them to unfund the surge and to bring the troops home. And I'd encourage everyone to do the same. No matter how your senators stand, the more they hear from us, the more the chances that we can influence them.
Amen. Thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you.
Victoria, just on that point, we had Barbara Lee on in the first hour of the program talking about her resolution to stop Bush should he decide he's going to go into Iran. What do you think the chances of that getting onto the floor and getting a decent vote are?
Well, I think it could get on the floor. I think it could get a decent vote, but I still don't think it'll stop him.
Yeah. You think it could pass, though?
I think it could pass. I think they have to word it very carefully. I mean, I spoke to Representative Lynn Woolsey this morning, and she didn't strike me as being particularly temperate, when it comes to wording.
Right. Right.
So, if they're careful on their wording, I think it could pass. I think people are very, very worried about what the president might do with Iran.
Right.
But I just have this feeling that he would issue a signing statement saying, "Yeah, I'm signing it,"
I agree with you. I agree with you, Jeff from Denver. We have about half a minute. Hey, Jeff.
Just want to mention two diseases I think Americans should be aware of: Reaganitis and Reaganosis. And Reaganitis is an inflammation of the budget based on overspending in the 80s. And Reaganosis is a psychosis that thinks that Reagan did anything good for this country.
There you go. Well said, Jeff. Thank you very much. Thank you for the call. And Victoria Jones, thank you for being with us, the Talk Radio News Service, and for the great reporting that you do day after day, going in there, watching Fox News, among others, and dealing with Tony Snow. Man, Victoria, you are doing a job that I couldn't do. I salute you.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us.
Bye.
Tomorrow, on our program tomorrow, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders here taking your calls. Also, I'll be challenging conservative Carol Tabor. She says, liberals are proselytizing college professors against the Bush administration, and it's working. Uh-oh. Plus, on-the-air book, Cracking the Code. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.